Welcome to the Start Well podcast. I'm Dawn Thomas, your host. As a mother, financial advisor, and researcher, I know the importance of empowering young people on their financial journeys. Whether you're a parent, grandparent, or the coolest aunt or uncle, join me in exploring how impactful conversations about money can shape a young person's future. Let's harness their superpower of time and your superpower of influence to ensure they start well and continue to live well into the future. The information discussed in this podcast is general in nature and does not take into account your personal and financial objectives and situation. Before acting on any information discussed here, you should consider its appropriateness, having regard to your objectives, needs, and financial position. Welcome to the very first episode of the Start Well podcast. Parents, guardians, grandparents, the cool uncle or aunt, this is for you. And to kick us off with our very first episode, we have the amazing Lacey Filipich, the author of Money School. Welcome to the podcast, Lacey.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Dawn. I'm delighted to be here and just absolutely ecstatic that you're doing a podcast for these incredible role models in these young people's lives. It's fantastic.
Yes. And Lacey, you recorded a little video for the kids who attend our Start Well workshops that we have for clients. And you said, time is your superpower, right? And I've been reflecting on that because I love that line and I've used it a few times. But I think for parents, influence is your superpower. And for kids, time is your superpower. And I think both of those superpowers diminish with time. Parents have the influence for a certain amount of time. And kids, you know, as you get older, that of course the investment time frame sort of narrows down. So thank you for giving me something to reflect on how that applies with parents. And like we said, this is also for grandparents, or for those of you who don't have kids as well. I'm sure your awesome uncles or aunts or best friends, kids that you look after. Today's episode is about discussing Lacey's book, Money School, because this book has actually come up on a list of a few recommendations, right? So a number of people that are in the finance industry have said that this is one of their favorite books. So we're going to take it through. The reason why I was so engaged to this book, Lacey, was that you use storytelling and you reflected on your own journey as well, writing it. And you know how when we started this, you kind of said, before we started recording, you said that, you know, you're kind of delighted that we're talking to parents because you started off Money School with that whole purpose of doing that. Can you tell us a bit about that first? Because then we got Money School, the book as well.
Yes, happy to. So yeah. I had the ovarian lottery win of getting a mum who consciously talked to me about money from quite a young age. And I, like you said, I do include this storytelling in the book so you can read the details, but the high level story is I started saving half of every dollar when I was 10. I started investing when I was 19 and I got to financial independence when I was 31 as a result. So save early, save hard, start investing early was definitely the message that I got. And it was just because my mum planted these seeds in these little conversations. She didn't lecture me. She just, you know, she'd ask me little questions and she'd work off what she knew worked with me. She approached my sister very differently because different kids, right?
Yeah.
And it was only when I was in my 20s that I realized that not everybody had a mum like mine. Not everyone's mum did that. And, of course, our school system, although financial literacy has since been added into the school system, we're not great at teaching it at school. And actually, I agree with quite a number of people in the workspace in financial education that home is actually probably the most powerful and most sensible place to be teaching kids about money because so much of what you learn is about values, right? And your priorities. And it's very hard to put that in a maths test or a business and economics test. There is some maths in there and there is some understanding, but actually that's only like a small amount of those decisions. And so I wanted to teach parents how to do what my mum had done. So I started out actually writing Money School was a series, it ended up just being one book that I wrote for kids that told them these money stories. So I wrote this Bunny Money book, which is for 6 to 8 year olds about why saving was important. And then I was going to teach parents. And that's actually the first thing I did was write a course for parents, which was, hey, here's the skill. And then here's how you teach the skill to your kids, because sometimes they hadn't learned the skill either. But what I found over time was I had a heap of people starting to come in going, yeah, that's lovely about the teaching the kids, but I didn't learn, Lacey. Like, you can teach me about how to teach my kids, but really I want to know. And so over time, it's been 14 years now, Money School has become much more focused on teaching adults the skills that we wish we'd learned when we were younger. But I still do teach parents. I've got a course that's about teaching parents so they can take some activities home to do with their kids. And I run a business that's straight to the kids. So that's teaching kids through enterprise. So it's still in there, but it's just not the focus anymore. It turns out there's a lot of adults going, yeah, I wish I learned that. Can you just teach me the skills?
Yes.
So that's what the money school.
Yeah, we found that as well. I think Lacey said we know initially when we had our first, like I told you, all of this was the experiment that we're doing around Startwell. And it's honestly, I would love to look back in 10 years and see how we've evolved it. But we were like focusing on, let's have the workshop for the kids. And then we had the parent session really just to inform parents as to what we were going to do with their kids. And then we got all these questions from the parents. And I'm thinking, oh no, we actually have to focus a lot more on the parents. Even with the parent session, we'll teach the kids, but we need to give parents some checklists and guidelines after the kids have come to us to continue those journeys at home. So because,
exactly,
I mean, there's only so much you can achieve in an hour. but yeah, so I totally get that. And this book is, you know as well that I've gotten my son to try and start reading it as well, and my daughter, and they said so far they can understand what's going on. So that's a good
take. Hooray.
Hooray.
Oh, thumbs up. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, yeah, that's a 12-year-old and a 13-year-old who said they can understand what's happening.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, so jumping into the basis of your book as well, because even when we started the class, I asked the kids about retirement. What does that mean to you? Because you have a section about financial independence, time rich, right? So how is that actually pronounced? It's like, I got like fish.
I'm
like,
I know.
You know, like I got fire.
The
like,
irony. I know. We've got this acronym, which is FITR, financially independent, time rich. And whether you say it fighter or fitter, I'm like the least logical person to have either of those. I am neither a fighter or fit.
Fighter.
But you can pick. I end up. And actually in the audiobook, you have to choose. And I just ended up spelling it out each time, F-I-T-R. So you can pick, Dawn. You can be fighter or fitter. You pick, man.
I've been doing F-I-T-R because I don't even know where to start. So fighter, I like that, okay, because we kind of hear more about fire. And you've said in the book that you got to know about the term fire, I suppose, in 2016. But, you know, fighter was something that you had already learned, probably from your mum, you know, with Fran actually giving you those lessons. So could you just tell our listeners, firstly, that concept of, like in your book, when you're trying to talk to readers about, here is what we know about retirement, but here is what else retirement can be in relation to those terms? Yeah.
Yeah. And look, I had personal experience that got me thinking about this. I had a quarter life crisis, and that's where I actually started exploring the idea of what is retirement? Mm-hmm. Retirement is this idea that came about in the late 1800s for people who were turning 70 to get a wage. And of course, most people were dying by that point. So it wasn't a lot of people. But it's this archaic idea that we're going to work like maniacs for 40 or 50 years. And then finally, as we're getting old and grey, we're going to get to have a break. And that's when we're going to feel time rich, right? So that's this end of life retirement concept that's been around for a long time. But not permanently. As I said, it's late 1800s. So it's only 130 odd years that's been around. Okay, that's a long time. That's enough. But yeah. but this idea that you have to wait until you're old to enjoy this feeling of being time rich, which is what retirement is. It's this sense of getting to choose how you spend your time, because you no longer have to spend your time earning money. Because of course we spend on average, you know, somewhere between 30 and 40, maybe 50 hours a week through most of our working lives, earning an income to put a roof over our heads and food in our belly and pay for all the things we need. But when it's not a choice, when you're forced to, it can take some of the joy and the satisfaction out of the experience. And we often hear of people choosing careers for the money reasons that maybe they wouldn't have chosen if they didn't have that constraint. So what happened to me in my, you know, around 26 is I got really sick and had a period of like 5 weeks where I was bedridden and had this like, what does it all mean? And started reading The 4-Hour Workweek, which I know is a bit cult-like, Tim Ferriss. And it talked about mini retirements, bringing these mini retirements, these chunks of time off, like the end of life retirement, into your youth while you still could do all the things you wanted to do. And they'd be periods of, you know, like a few to 12 months off at a time. So I started taking these mini retirements and I was like, this is amazing. And alongside that, I'd been investing. I wasn't yet financially independent, but I was getting there. And of course, when I did hit financial independence at 31, it was just soon after my daughter was born. And I had the realization that, hey, I don't actually have to go back to work if I didn't want to. I had enough income from my assets to cover our living costs. And I was, that was like, oh, wow, I could do this forever now if I want to. And that was when I sort of realized, first of all, that this is the point, getting to choose, but second of all, that being off work forever is actually really boring. Most people who are ambitious enough to earn and save enough to become financially independent get bored after about 6 months. You're not going to spend the rest of your life sitting on your hands. And that is what happened when I found FIRE. People were getting stuck on the RE, the retire early. They're going, but I don't want to retire. Yeah. The point is not that you retire. The point is that it's a choice. Everything you do now is a choice because you don't have to turn up to work. And I find that that's an incredibly motivating goal, particularly for young people who care more about social causes. They want to do more good. They don't just want a job for the money. Getting them motivated to think about, hey, I need to save and invest so that I can spend my time working on things that I think are really important and are really satisfying for me and not feeling like I am compelled to go to work even if I don't like it. Now, the good news is most people still do keep working. There's lots of people who keep doing the same job even when they're financially independent because they love it so much. That's the point. You get to choose. There's no like retirement police that goes, you're financially independent, get out of the workforce now. But that's why I like to say time rich, because the RE just confuses people. They get the wrong impression because of what we think of retirement. I find time rich is much more empowerment for people. That's why I use that instead.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, you're talking about choice. And I like in the book as well, it's like you're going, okay, there's the FI, financial independence part of it, and then there's time rich part of it. And you almost have to like, okay, you've achieved the FI part. Then how do you actually deal with the time rich part, you know, because the numbers and the money are one thing, but being able to enjoy and understand what meaning that has. I particularly liked it towards the end of the book where you say this is what FIRE is not going to solve in your life as well.
Yeah, well, all those little things that you think, oh, if I just had more money, that'd fix it, are true up to a certain point. You know, if you hadn't hit a certain level, it would make your life easier. But then past a certain point, all those things are still going to be problems. So just gives you time to work on them, though. You do have the time and resources to work on them, so that is an advantage. But no, they're not going to magically disappear.
It's a very well-rounded book because of that. I think it goes between the personal development side and the money side of it. I think that's where every chapter is actually weaved in that way, and it's done actually brilliantly. Like the way I would see this working for parents is that I would say you need to really sit into this opening bit of content around the book around FIRE, because I think you should be talking to the kids about what they envision retirement is. I think this just requires read that bit as yourself as a parent, pause, and then you need to have a few conversation with your kids. So like, let's not try and get through the whole book first. Would you agree, Lacey, like at the starting point, let's talk about what that means?
Absolutely. And it is a book that I've written that's designed to be jumped in and out of. Like you can flick to the chapter that you want. You know, it's quite educational content, but you're right, there is mixes in there of stories and reflection and what do you want, that kind of stuff. So there is no rule that's like, you must read the whole book and then you can talk about it. No, definitely that first bit's really good. And I think when you're thinking about what you want to express to your kids as well, you being able to put it in the context of your priorities and your life is really important. I always get a bit nervous about teaching kids directly because I'm like, well, your mum and dad might not agree with everything that I'm about to say, or your grandparents or your guardian or your whatever, whoever it is. It might be that we think differently. You know, like a really good example of that is donations. So like, who should you give to and how much should you give? That's a really big question, you know, and there's a lot of ways to answer it. There's people who will say, well, I'm going to work as much as I can and give it all away when I'm done, and that's the best thing I could do. That was like a Warren Buffett original. He was like, well, I should make all this money until I'm in my 70s and then I'll give some chunks away. And others are like, oh, you know, you should work as hard as you can and live on as little as you can and give away all that. And then there's effective altruism, which says, you know, oh, well, you shouldn't give to guide dogs, you should give to Fred Hollows. You know, like those sorts of things, that there's so much in there. That is a values, ethics, beliefs discussion, and that belongs between the family. You are a best place to guide your child through that, much better placed than any teacher that I can think of. We can give them the theory, but you helping them navigate is really important. So you're taking those breaks, having those chats, putting it in your personal context, what you think and believe and how you operate. And like, I haven't even mentioned religion, but obviously there's massive implications with that as well. Yes. It's really important that you are conscious of that so that you're not finding that they're learning something and you go, nah, that's not quite right. And it helps them build that critical reasoning as well. That sort of, does this work for me? What are the limits here? You know, so a lot of what I've written has designed for that way. I've tried to give a lot of the information. Here's the pros and here's the cons and here's the ways you could go. Here's when it's worked well. Here's where it hasn't worked, just to make sure that people aren't just getting the glossy, oh, I must follow these rules. I must save 20%. It's not a rule. Someone just made that up.
That's right. I think I get when people go, like I've seen slides, let's say going out to young people saying, this is ideally 20% here, goes here for this 20%. And I'm like, that is not how it works necessarily. I know as a parent, I'm the same in the way that, and now I don't even know that whether, you know, that sort of, whether I've stolen it from your book, because I'm wondering, where did I get this 50% figure
you
from?
Haven't
I
run... stolen it. You haven't stolen it. Yeah, I might have. It's, like, it's part of the universe, mate. Yeah. There's other people that do it as well. Don't worry, you're not stealing anything. And if you did, I'd still be delighted, because spread the word, right? Like, yes. The more saving, the better.
No, I read it a few years ago, right? Because your book was published in 2020. And and the about 50%, I told my kids, have to go towards long-term saving. So the conversation I'm having with them now is going, we're trying to save up for this first house, practically, because we just said it's going to be challenging to get into the property market. And we talk about intergenerational wealth transfer. I said, this has not happened to your parents. We're both immigrants and we both basically built from zero. So I'm sorry, it's not happening with these two parents you have here. So we are going to help you with the lessons with money to get you to the point that when you're older, you'll be able to do that. So non-negotiable is 50% goes towards the long-term goal, which will be, at this point, we've put a goal to it, which is house. So they can picture something, right? But now you bought your first house at 19 and you said in the book, okay, whether this sounds controversial or not, your last house purchase was your principal residence. In the book, that's what you stated. What are your views on that first home? Like, I mean, I guess because parents want to talk to their kids about houses, is it always going to have to be a principal residence? I mean, how do you have a discussion about property?
This is a massive cultural problem. So there's two things that happen here. So one is the Australian dream is own your own home. Mm. And the old advice that we've heard for generations is own your own home first, right? Like that has been, it's part of our psyche.
Yes.
And we're a big country with lots of space, you know, we're not a dense country. So people think I need a house, right? So that's the first thing. The second thing is we've got this crisis where wages have not kept up with house price growth. So the ability for people to buy a house has gotten harder and harder. And look, there might be people listening to this that are like, but my grandparents sacrificed. They gave up, you know, they went without, and kids today, they expect everything. Look, whether that is true or not, and look, there is no doubt that we have expected more convenience from our lives and that we have more instant gratification. And that is kind of a product of the society we live in and the marketing. It has objectively gotten harder to buy a house. Much harder. It is taking the ratio of average wage to house price is your gauge on this. Yeah. And in your grandparents' day, it was 3 to 5 times their annual wage. And now, depending on where they live, it can be 10 to 13 times their annual wage. And just think of the implication of that in terms of how long it takes them to pay something off. Mm. So objectively, it's gotten harder. So those two things are really important to know about Australia, right? There's this innate design and there's this sense of failure. If you rent. Now, in other places in the world, it is normal to rent for your entire life. Normal, right? Like completely normal. And there are plenty of people who would rather rent than own for a bunch of reasons, like being able to move whenever you want to, not having to deal with the maintenance, like the ongoing costs, you know. And actually the maths is not clearly in favor of owning a home. Like most people will say this to themselves, oh, but the reason to own your home is rent money is dead money. I keep doing that voice, don't I, every time I'm mimicking someone. it's dead money. You shouldn't do it. You know, it's not dead money. It can be perfectly legitimate if you're investing elsewhere. It can be a better lifestyle choice. So I think in Australia, we've got to get better at doing the long-term leases, the like 10 to 20-year leases that are common in Europe. We don't do that in Australia. If we can do that and give people confidence, that's going to be great. But we also have a massive supply shortage. We've got too many people coming into the country and not enough houses being built at the same time to accommodate them. And COVID made this worse. Everybody wanted to live separately because they don't want to share diseases and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So there's been some changes that have meant we need more homes and we don't have them. And that's why house prices are going up. So that background is why I'll often say to people, Look, and it worked for me. I had bought 5 investment properties before we bought a principal place of residence, right? You know, it's 13 years of property investing before I bought a home to live in. By the time we bought the home to live in, we knew we were having children. We knew we wanted at least 2. We knew where we wanted to live. So I didn't mind paying a big stamp duty, you know, the huge deposit, taking on a decent mortgage. I was happy because I knew where I wanted to be. When you're younger, it's much harder to know these things. You know, the apartment that I bought when I was 19 was a 2x1 apartment, 50 square meters. I don't think I could live there by myself now. You know, like it's not going to suit me in adulthood, you know. So I think this idea that you're going, the first major asset you're going to buy is going to be a home. We don't stay in those homes for long times anymore. We're not getting married that early. We're not having kids that early. We're not picking the job that early. You know, like it's unreasonable for people to be thinking that they're going to be buying their home in their 20s because they know all those things. Mm. So I'd like to see us take the pressure off, but I don't want us to take the pressure off never getting one. I just think it's a good thing to delay until you know where you're going, because the capital cost, that stamp duty that I mentioned, the deposit, the mortgage, those costs are enormous. Mm. And if you lock yourself into one of those really early in your 20s, like what happens when you meet someone else, you want to move to, you know, somewhere else in the world or somewhere else in Australia?
Yeah.
You can still get into the property market. You can still get into other types of investing without having to own your own home. So I would like to see a house price correction. I say that as a property investor. I'd like to see it become more affordable. And I think there's systemic changes that need to happen. But for individuals, I'd say if you fixate on this idea of a home is essential for you, it's a security decision, not necessarily the best financial decision, and it has a lot of potential downsides. Mm. So if you can shift that thinking a little bit, then you might find the pressure comes off and it becomes more achievable, because that's what happened. You know, I did the 5 properties and that's what helped fund the principal place of residence that I have always wanted and I could see myself living in for the next 30 years, you know. So that's that progression, I think, if we treat it as a stepping stones, you know, we talk about rungs on the property ladder, that kind of stuff. It can be more achievable for young people and it can be less depressing for them, because that's the thing I find very hard, is how depressing it must be as a young person if you don't have the bank of mum and dad gifting you $90,000 for your deposit, which is what the average is apparently. It must feel awful for them, and it is going to exacerbate that wealth divide. So how can we help those people? Make your goal slightly different, get there eventually, but go by a different path.
Yeah. And so we think about this as a talking point for parents. So let's say we've highlighted a talking point would be, let's have a conversation with the kids about retirement and what that could mean. And then, you know, ask them what's of value to them and how they want to achieve that. This bit about property also, because that seems to be a hot topic with parents, like that's a worry of theirs. I've already talked to my kids about the fact that I don't mind them being at home for a while, right? So, I mean, I think that's the thing as well, is that isn't that the reality that we might be seeing, that kids will be living at home longer? So how can parents then, because, you know, you've got this, you've got your particular way of addressing it, right? You save, buy asset and avoid bad debt, right? So mm-hmm. that's parents. Lacey has broken it down in 3 simple steps. Across the whole book. So save, buy asset, and avoid bad debt. Let's say if the kids are staying at home longer, they've got their first jobs, you know, and they are trying to find their balance between the time rich and financial independence balance. Mm. How would that work then with a conversation with your kids about how to structure things?
Mm. It's a really, again, individual question for the family. So every family's got, and there's massive cultural implications with this, right? You know, mm-hmm. like the capitalist democratic Caucasian society that, you know, like I have existed in is very much, you know, you get out of home and you know, you don't share. And then I think about Indigenous Australians that are all about sharing, you know, like imagine that. Imagine trying to coexist, you know, like, so there's, I guess I'm trying to frame it with, there's no right or wrong here, but I think we can pretty much all agree that what we don't want to do is raise kidults. We don't want these adult children in our house still behaving like children and unable to look after themselves if they had to. Okay. Yeah. So I think that's the goal you've got to keep in mind, right? Mm. It's fine to support your kids. It's fine to have them at home, but what you don't want is a 30-year-old who doesn't understand what things cost and could not live by themselves if they had to. Right. That is where I think we just need to keep this balance in mind. So what that means is you sometimes have to arbitrarily create a little bit of pain for them. Now, we all hate doing this, right? But as we know, if you make easy choices, you pay for them later. Every lazy parenting decision I've made has come back to bite me. And it's cost me 10 times as much energy to fix it, you know? All the things where I'm like, why did I let them get away with that? So that has really changed my parenting style. I will now be harder than I actually need to be.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, because, you know, you often think, oh, but I want to be nice to my kids. I want to give them the things I didn't have. Well, now I will, you know, put them into situations where they are going without a little bit so they can learn the things they need to learn. Not because I don't have the resources, but because if they don't learn those skills, I'm doing them a disservice.
Yes.
Okay. So I think when you're having that discussion, it's fine, like as they get older, and we don't want to stress them out about money, but having them understand decision making. So I always think about there's like three principles you want kids to understand. Mm-hmm. So one is time is precious. So if you earn money, don't waste it, right? Like use it to good effect. So this is the same as we turn the tap off when we're brushing our teeth, all that kind of thing. We don't waste the resources we've got. So that's the first one. The second one is know what enough is for you. And it's different for everybody. And that's the goal you're investing towards. So what is enough looking like? And that's a big part of money skills, understanding what your goal is. And then three, every choice you make has an opportunity cost. So you need to make good choices with future you in mind. Now that's the one I think that we have to focus on with our kids when we're trying to equip them and if we're going to keep them at home, making sure they understand the decision to stay at home has costs. It needs to have some costs eventually. I'm talking about when kids are earning an income. I personally, philosophically think when they're studying or learning, that's fine. You know, you don't expect it to pay for it. But if you're earning an income and you're living for free, that's not real. You know, you're creating an arbitrary thing. But that's a personal value. I understand there are plenty of, you know, cultures that don't agree with me on that. So take it as you see it there. But trying to create this situation where you have that kind of understanding of its contribution, it's part of being in the family and this is the reality of life and having that grow over time. I think it's easier to do that progressively, particularly through high school. You know, as they start getting part-time jobs and you say, well, I'm not going to be buying, like I'll buy you your basics, but I'm not going to be buying you the fancy shoes anymore. You're now earning an income. You buy the shoes, right? You know, like if you want the fancy $200 sneakers, I'll buy you the ones for school, but you're buying those ones. You know, that kind of those little things that you can do. And if you can get them to learn those three rules, the save, buy assets, avoid bad debt, like there's no numbers in there, right? There's no percentages or anything like that. Those are three that will stand them in very good stead. And they actually link to those three principles I was talking about. So that I think if you can have those conversations and create those situations and let them fail a bit, you have to be prepared to let them buy the stupid thing that you know they're going to regret.
Yes.
Fine, go buy it. And then they're like a week later, they're like, why did I spend money on that? And like, I know, don't do it again. Right. You know, like getting some, you know, borrowing some money from you or borrowing some money, you know, to do something and then going, oh my gosh, there's interest payments and oh, I didn't pay the interest and oh, now I've lost my bike, which I lose this, put up as collateral. You know, like they might feel arbitrary, but having them experience that when the stakes are low, letting them make a few mistakes, let them get the $500 credit card and rack up some debt and then go, oh my God, now I have to pay $2,000 back when they haven't paid anything but minimum payments for 2 years. They're 18. It's not going to kill them. They're not going to lose their home. Let them make the mistakes because those lessons will stick with them. And I think that is really hard. And when we try to coddle our kids and we try to make life smooth for them because life's so hard and all that sort of stuff, we don't give them skills that they're going to need. And that's really a disservice to them. And we bear the brunt of it. So yeah, don't take those shortcuts, parents.
Oh, look, there's so many actually great parts of your book, right? That I'm just like, I have to pick and choose what we want to talk about, but I feel like I want to talk about everything and I can't. So I'm going to, in terms of timing wise with the kids and conversations. So it's good that you're talking about opportunity costs, about them picturing the future, you know, just being a bit more intentional, right, with what they're doing. I think that's where the guidance you want to give as parents. There is this chapter in there and there was a little blurb about, you know, if you're trying to get your savings goals and your investing goals, and Christmas rolls around, right? And then, and I like the little tips you gave because I think I've honestly been so, I don't know if stress is the right word. I don't actually like Christmas coming, right? You know, for me growing up, Christmas was actually a religious holiday in Singapore, not so much about the presents. Even though I'm not very religious now, but I still find it's dominated by giving. And as the person who is the gift buyer in the family, I just feel it's a whole lot of buying gifts for no reason. When all year we have with the family, the kids don't get pocket money. but they get money for academic achievement, sporting achievement, good behavior, helping out with chores. And then suddenly Christmas rolls around and it's like, you're given all this stuff without, for me, it's like, I don't know what you've done to earn that. I don't know, that might sound harsh or I might sound like a cringe, but I feel like I'm going against a whole culture and society that may not understand that maybe I don't want my family to participate in that. Because there are other saving goals that I want to achieve, you know, like for me personally, it was like, I want to build my emergency funds up again, because emergency funds do get depleted and then you've got to build them up again. I do want to be able to go back and see my mom in Singapore, but you know, when you're moving five people, because you know, it would be the 12 month death anniversary of my dad. Those things are meaningful things that I want to save for. But how you've outlined it in your books, Lacey, and I know Christmas now has become like an afterthought, but Christmas is going to come again this year. How can we prepare the family for that conversation internally and externally, that the family's choosing to spend their money in a different way rather than everything that needs to happen for that event?
And this is, again, such a hard one to escape because of the traditions that have been associated with it. And on top of the traditions, which I think were very well-meaning and probably had great intent and got the result they needed, we've got this massive commercial layer, right? So you're talking about this marketing pressure that we're getting now, that you must have all the things.
Yes.
You know, the table's got to have new bloody plates, all that stuff. Oh, well, which one have you bought this season? And that, I think, that is the dangerous stuff. There's a difference between the giving a meaningful, caring gift for people and choosing that as a significant moment to do it versus this whole, well, we have to have all the things and all the things now. And that's the bit that I think I find very hard with Christmas too, and I can relate to your problem there, Dawn.
Yes.
I think approaching it as this opportunity cost is definitely a worthwhile discussion to have. So, look, you know, and I remember having, it's not Christmas, but this discussion with my daughter. She wasn't yet three. She wanted, we, you know, had a stool, potty training, washing hands, all that stuff. And she wanted the stool with Winnie the Pooh on the front, which was $14. And next to it was the, you know, the you know, generic brand
normal one.
It was $5, right? And they were identical stools, just a different one had Winnie the Pooh on the front, one had the other one. And she was like, I want the $14 one. She didn't say that. She's like, I want the Winnie the Pooh one. And I had this discussion with her. It happened the whole way we were walking from the stools to the checkout. She's carrying the Winnie the Pooh stool, I'm carrying the other stool. And we're having this discussion that goes along the lines of, look, I know you want it, but just to make you understand, if we buy that stool, I spend this amount of money. If I buy the other stool that I've got, then we can also buy milk and bread for the week. That's how much the extra money is. And look at how similar the stools are. Like, look at them. They're the same.
Yes.
What if we just bought you a sticker to put over the front? And like, we get to the counter and I'm using the context of waste. Like, yeah, we can buy that one for this reason, we buy this very comparable one, and then we get this, you know, extra on top of it, that opportunity cost thing. This is wasteful, you know, this discussion of course I can afford it, but it's wasteful to spend our money that way. Let's think about how we best use our resources. And by the end she went, you're right, and she put the Winnie the Pooh stool down and we took the other stool home, and I never even had to buy the Winnie the Pooh sticker. Because of course I got forgotten about 2 minutes after we got through the door. No one cares anymore. No one looks at the stool. Like, it could be any stool. No one looks at the stool. So those kinds of discussions about that opportunity cost of, hey, look, we're working towards this goal as a family. There are many more meaningful ways to show you care someone than buying gifts, and particularly spending lots of money on it. And when you've got a goal like you're talking about, like, we're not dissimilar in our family. We're planning a big trip.
Yes.
We want to go to Europe. Yep. It's going to be expensive, you know. So this Christmas was, hey, guys, I'm not buying you lots of things. I'm not going to buy things to put in storage. I'm going to buy a couple of, you know, significant things, but they're going to be small, and that's it. And that was the discussion why. Like, well, when we want to be able to go to Disneyland Paris. I don't want to have a discussion about we can't afford it, you know. That's why. And that uniting in common goals, I think, it's really helpful for the kids to see that, especially when it's discretionary spending, you know, when it's, you know, it's these things you want to do, not the, you know, the must-do stuff. You don't want to stress them out too much.
Yes.
But recognize that commercialism that has just gotten into all of us, and you're allowed to say no. You're allowed to wait till the sales. You're allowed to, you know, go to Boxing Day instead and get bargains and buy the same thing for half the price. Make that a family tradition. You're allowed to, you know, give them gifts. You're allowed to that are related to buying shares, you know, money kind of thing.
That's right.
You're allowed to, you know, make stuff. Like, we don't have to buy into the commercialism, and helping our kids understand that, and that seeing that that's the process when they come home and go, I think this thing that I've just seen everybody's got. Yeah. Getting them to sort of critically think about that, you're going to help them improve that delayed gratification skill, which is really important for kids to learn because we don't get many opportunities to practice it these days.
Yes, and I think that's why in your book you've got a few different points and tips, right? Like you're saying that, oh, if you know, if you really want to spend money on me, you know, there's some shares that I want to buy. You can actually, you can give me the cash. I'll invest it and I'll think of you fondly.
Yeah, every time I get a dividend, I'll be like, thanks, yeah. Mom. Thanks, Dad.
And I'm like, yep. yes, that is sort of, I think those are sort of the helpful tips around these tricky conversations, because I think everything is pervasive that goes through your day, that you're feeling a lot of challenges around how your money is pulling in one direction over the other, you know, because you said in your book, the way that you can increase the safe element, that very first step, that safe element could be earning more or spending less.
Exactly. Both things. And of course, I like the first one. I like to earn more. That's my personal preference. Yes. And I think if we encourage the kids to try and earn more, then that's great. Go and, you know, you've got more spending cash.
Yeah. And that's where I'm kind of also fascinated from your book and this concept, because not, growing up in Australia, I'm not being aware of how it works here job-wise, right? Because I come from Singapore where white-collar workers are the ones that earn a lot of money, right? And they literally, you need to have like a degree or a master's to be able to be successful. That's why, you know, and it's quite, it's not uncommon in Asian countries. That's sort of the way it's structured. And then they'll kind of scare you when you're in school. If you do something that's more manual, that means like you failed. And I came to Australia, I'm like, oh my goodness, everyone's given an opportunity. Like a degree is not something that is needed, right? So that for me is like, they told me lies. They told me lies when I was in Singapore. And now I'm in Australia. And it does.
Well, I told you the truth for Singapore.
They told me the truth for, correct. I was there. That's the truth for Singapore. So I think sometimes, and that's where I want to get away with the, we know that kids want to do something for purpose, right? I guess you've gone through your own journey of being very smart with the jobs you picked that allowed you to earn more than your friends and then therefore save more but not lose out with the social stuff. If our parents or uncles or aunts or grandparents listening to this podcast are wanting to have their conversation with their loved ones about their first jobs, like how would you, what are the things to watch out for with that consideration between earning capacity early on, but also with the fighter concept, effectively is how they use their money, not really the job that they're in. So I'm just wanting to know how you see these two concepts interacting with each other.
Oh, I love this question, Dawn. You've given us a lot of thought. So look, the first thing I would say to people is the only way you're going to get to financial independence generally is by earning enough money and having excess to be able to save and invest. So your ability to earn a decent income is pivotal if that is your goal, right? And if that's the goal that your kids want to work towards, they have to acknowledge that too. And this is where we see that battle for people who want to do good and they end up doing these jobs that are lesser paid, often in the not-for-profit space. And then they can't get to financial independence because that of what's happened. Now, that's a choice. Everybody can make that choice. What really worries me is when I hear parents say things like, oh, I don't want them to get a part-time job because I want them to focus on study. Mm. That's a massive risk with that. They need to learn to be able to manage their time, but more importantly, they need to find out what they love and what they don't love. Mm. And there's nothing worse than a kid that's gone through their entire schooling career plus 4 years of a degree or 5 years of a degree at university only to get into the workforce in their early 20s and go, this job sucks.
Yeah.
It turns out I don't like talking to people and this job requires me to talk to people. So like for me, I started working as soon as I could, like absolutely as soon as I could. And I was running businesses when I was 10. And then as soon as I could get a tax file number at 13 years and 9 months, I was off getting a job and I did everything. Like if I look at the list of jobs that I did before I was 19, there's about 20 on there. And it was through that experience that I went, I am not cut out for retail. The end of story. Like that's just not me. And I also learned what different jobs paid and I understood where I could make more money. So that example you're talking about, one of my mates went and got jobs at McDonald's, the big fast food chain. They were all in there earning $5.60 something an hour. And I was like, wow, that's not much. And then, of course, there was gymnastics coaching and I've been doing gymnastics. It turned out it paid like $13 or $14 an hour. And so I became the youngest ever qualified gymnastics coach. I got it at 14 instead of 16 because I was like, I want to do this. You know, like, and that's deliberate. If you don't start thinking about that early, it's going to come as a shock later on. So I think we need to be prepared to let our kids do these things. And like, I was working 12 hours a week from year nine during school, and I'd work 30 hours a week on school holidays. So I realize I am an excessive case here. But let them have a part-time job, please, like in high school. They need to try different things. They need to understand the values. They need to be able to talk to customers. They need to have that commercial acumen. They need to do all that sort of stuff. And if you don't let them do it when they're younger, they are going to struggle in their 20s. Mm. And they risk going down a path of like a career that is not going to fit them. And the opportunity cost of that, having to reskill later, the mental health impacts, like imagine how much that's worth, right? So we don't want to create that situation for our kids, but they do need to know that they're not going to get to financial independence by sitting on their butts. Mm. They have to get up and earn the money, and they have to be willing to ask for more money, and they have to be willing to make themselves promotable, you know, doing a good job, delivering well and seeking out those opportunities. And the sooner they see that, and that's how life works, the better it's going to be for them. And that's why I guess I do focus on those younger years, you know, 10 to 12. Let them start a business. They can't go get a job yet, but let them have the experience. Let them fail. Let them experiment. Let them talk to some humans and build that confidence. Their chances of finding the career they want to do in the future are higher if you let them do that. So you're not actually protecting them, I think, by not making them do it, you know, by saying, oh, well, you don't need to work while you're studying. That is actually, I think, in most cases, hindering. So I realize that's quite firm. So I'm sorry if there are any parents out there. You can carry on not letting your children's work if you want to, but just recognize that you are shortchanging them, I think, in that opportunity to work out what's good for them and to learn these skills early so that they do have a chance of earning a good income. And another thing I always push on is this is why we need to get more women into STEM careers. You want to get paid more? Get a STEM job. They pay more. Mm. Yes. It's part of the reason I chose engineering. It's paid more than accounting.
Yes.
So, you know, that understanding and understanding what different jobs are paid and that you can legitimately do a job without qualifications and still earn a six-figure salary in Australia. It is achievable. It's not about saying, oh, well, you have to go to uni, but find the job you love that you can do well, that can pay you well so you can create this life that you want to create.
Mm. And, this is the thing. You get the job and then you make sure that the money is actually doing the work for you to get to, you know, financial independence and being time rich, right? So I totally get that. And because that helped me just not also understanding how it could work with my kids. So I do tell my kids, I'll be like, you know, Lacey says you can't work in McDonald's because she didn't, you know, I was rephrasing you.
McDonald's,
but I just said, if you do something like that, I said she went and she got her qualification to, you know, to be paid higher. That means she could have fun and then she could save. So like I've said it in a way, probably I've taken you out of context, but I'm having those conversations with them when they think about their first jobs is to actually be really thinking about what they're being paid, not just be happy that they're getting paid is going, you know, there is, everything has an opportunity cost, you know, you're using your time. So this is going to go towards this further goal you have. So when we talk about time rich, now there's a lovely diagram in your book, and there's a lot of diagrams and little story blurbs and all that is there, is that you talk about, because we'll try and be a bit kid friendly in this podcast, let's say the poop to goal ratio, right?
Yeah.
I think the point
bad stuff.
Yep. The bad stuff. So you're just like, you're trying to focus to do the stuff that's more of the golden and less of the bad stuff, poopy
stuff.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So that relates to the time rich part of it. Is that right, Lacey? Like, would you please just tell us a bit more? Yeah.
Yeah. So look, the way I think about, and this is, you know, your experience as a financial advisor, yeah. Dawn would talk to this. We've got these long-term goals, strategy goals. I've got to get to this point in 20 or 30 years or whatever it is, you know, this big picture stuff. But when we miss the day-to-day, that is actually what determines how happy you are sometimes. So you've got to have that direction. You've got to have that North Star or whatever you're working towards. But you also need to pay attention to what's happening in your day-to-day if you want to feel content in life. Now, the beautiful thing about becoming financially independent is that you get more choice about how you spend your time. But like we said before, it doesn't fix everything, right? You can be financially independent and still have plenty of miserable days if you don't pay attention to the more tactical side. And that's the bit about this poop to gold ratio. So life is full of things that you are going to have to do, things like brushing your teeth, exercise, eating well, paying the bills. They are needs. You must do those things. Let's not worry too much about the fact that you have to do them. just get them done. Okay. And that is, you know, you have to, there's a saying from Mel Robbins, you know, you have to parent yourself as you get older. At the moment, your parents will be telling you what to do. Eventually you actually have to still do those things. Yeah. You have to make yourself do them because they're never really fun. So those needs have to happen. Let's not waste time on them. Let's just get them done. Then there are things that are generally we'd call discretionary, optional, wants. And those fall into one or two buckets. They're either gold, things you absolutely love to do and they make you happy. These are things like your hobbies or hanging out with your friends or whatever it is that lights you up. And then there's the poop, the stuff that you're doing but you don't want to do. Now, unfortunately, life is always going to contain some poop. That's it. Don't worry about it. It's going to contain it. But if you can work on improving the ratio, so more gold, more of those things that light you up and less of the things that you really don't light you up, then you will have happier days. That's what being time rich, I think, is about. So taking this time to think about those activities and going, what I see a lot in adults, I mean, I wonder if the parents are listening and that will relate to this. Often when you're going through parenting, you've lost all your hobbies because yes. You're either working or you're parenting in those early years, right? Like there's not a lot of room for anything else. And suddenly you're like, oh, I'm not very happy. You're like the kids are suddenly taking up less of my time, but I'm not happy. And it's usually because they've lost a hobby.
Yes.
An outlet, a creative sport or whatever it might be, outlet to give them that bit of gold. And it's having that gold that allows you to do all the poop stuff, all the stuff that you don't want to do, because if that ratio is good enough, it's worth it. And we have to accept there's always, it's constant work. Life is constant work. There's always going to be pain. There's always going to be uncertainty. There's going to be things that we don't like. We have to do that. But if we can improve that ratio over time, then we will find our days, our weeks, our months are happier. Are more satisfying, more contentment. And so I think you've actually got to be quite deliberate about identifying what sits in those buckets for you. And are there things in the poop bucket that you go, I could get rid of that. Like changing this one thing would make a big difference to me. So like in our household, it's cleaning the toilets. Like it's a clear one for me. Like that is a, yes, it needs to happen in general, right? Like, but people do get away without doing it. So that's why it's not technically in the needs bucket, you know. I've certainly been to plenty of houses in my life where I don't think they'd been looked at for 12 months. But we pay a cleaner because that's one thing that I could outsource like it really makes a massive difference to them, like an outsized happiness increase.
Yes.
And it's good for marital harmony as well. So I find this, are there things like that that you could like get off your poop pile? Or are there things that you could add to your gold? And often they're things that have slipped off over time, things that just make your life happier, something that's creative, something that's with your friends, something that's sporting. Those sorts of things tend to come up regularly, but it might be something completely different. And try and optimize that ratio, but be conscious of it. Pay attention to it. Once a year, do a bit of an audit and make some decisions to improve that ratio, because there's no point in getting to financial independence and then being miserable. You may as well work to make it a happy experience. So that's how I like to do it.
You are just, you know, the wisdom that comes out. Like, I just keep on thinking, like, Lacey, I'm a bit sad because time, like, you know, goes away. And there's so much I want to cover in your book, right? So, okay, the one thing I'm going to say is that I'm not going to touch on, you know, more money coming in more than that, because there's a section in there that talks about how you can actually have those conversations at work, which I think they are really integral conversations for parents to have with their kids, you know, or, you know, the influential adult, the guardian to have with the kids. But it's also something that probably the parent, the person that might be listening to this podcast might need to take your own advice from that. So I think maybe work on that one yourself, because Lacey did an episode for me that is going to be out start of March for International Women's Day that explains exactly the gender pay gap. Now that episode on Your Money Story, which is my other podcast that I do, look, it's very much about empowering women and moving forward. So that's just a bit of a warning with that one. But Lacey does go into it and really break down why the gender pay gap is so harmful, especially to this concept of save, step one in what you're talking about. So I would say that if you really want to have that breakdown, listen to that episode. But the book goes into fantastic points, talking points with the workplace around that. So that's really important. And the last thing I just wanted to cover with you, because now I just have to pick, there's so many things I want to go through, but this is one thing I want to pick, is the conversation around the kids and their future partners. You know, you've mentioned the binding financial agreement, things like that, that are in there. Like, again, I know you've said that it depends on the household, but what are the kind of things you want to talk to kids about normalizing their future conversations with their partners moving forward.
Mm. So your questions are so good, Dawn. I love these ones. You've picked some of my favorite topics. So look, there is a thing that I say to kids regularly, and maybe it's not the best thing to say, but I do it anyway. The partner you choose will have the biggest financial impact on your life, mm-hmm. right? Like that is finding a partner who you can align in common goals and who you are supportive of each other and you can trust each other. That is actually going to be the foundation for a lot of people for financial independence. Now, that's not to say you have to have a partner. Plenty of people don't have partners, very happy that way. It's fine. But if you are going to live with someone, you want to be absolutely sure. And it's very hard, I think, for a lot of people because there's a taboo around money. You know, there's a saying that people would rather talk about their sex lives than about their finances, you know, rather stand there naked than to be in my bank account. That's pretty depressing. But it is a hangover from the way that society, and particularly like our very English-oriented basis that we come from, it was poor form. Ew, we don't talk about those things. Ew, that's on the news. You know, like you don't do that, right? Like it's not considered cool. So you've got to normalize talking about money so that your kids don't grow up with that in general. But you definitely need to normalize them talking to their partners about that and early. Now, again, people might be more willing to talk about going to bed with their partner than having a chat about what you spend your money on in the first instance in those early days. Mm. So getting comfortable having those discussions is really important, and having them in from a place of curiosity, of trying to understand rather than a judgment. Oh, you're not trying to buy a house. Oh, well, you're not very good at that. Oh, you're not earning much money. Oh, you're not, you know, less of that judgment, more of a like, oh, why is that important to you? Or what do you want to go? You know, those kinds of things. So it's curiosity and getting to know them. So by having the conversations with our partners at home, so a husband and wife or, you know, whoever it is, two partners in a household that have children, having those chats in a deliberate way. So not to stress the kids out again. So I wouldn't recommend you have the like, oh my gosh, we're going to default on our mortgage payment chat in front of the kids. Okay. Don't do that. Hopefully none of you are going to have that experience, but sometimes people will. So we're not trying to stress the kids out. But having the discussions about your prioritization, how do you decide what to spend money on? So, for example, I mentioned we're looking to go to Europe, so I'm talking to my husband about, so what's going to be most cost effective for us for travel? Should we buy a round the world ticket or should we just go directly through here? What times should we fly? What days? Like, so they're little tiny conversations, but going through like, oh, here I've gone on to Skyscanner and I've got these different prices and here's our options. And my kids are getting curious about it. You know, they're like, oh, so which one are we going to do? So just having that little explaining the reasoning and seeing us talk about that is really good. Now, also resolving conflict. Mm. So we tend to, I said, you don't want to stress the kids out in terms of you don't want to make them worried that they're not going to be safe and loved, that they're going to lose a house. Okay. So try not to do that. But if you've got situations where you and your partner disagree about how you're going to spend money, you are allowed to have them in front of the children. Mm, so for example, my husband loves motorbikes. He wants to buy a new motorbike. My discussion is, why would you buy a motorbike now when we're going to just chuck it in storage when we go to Europe for ages? Can you not wait? Can you wait for this house? What are you going to do with the other bike? Are we going to have two motorbikes now? Are you going to be paying, you know, like those discussions, you can have those, particularly around when it's, you know, things that you, that aren't needs, that are like wants, you know, like it's optional to get another motorbike. Hearing you discuss that, resolve that, how you talk through it, like you're helping them see what relationships are really like. And I think that idea that both partners participate and it's not just one partner who runs off with it and they're in charge, that's essential to see that nobody gets to abdicate responsibility. You have to negotiate and it has to be a discussion. I think the more you can do that, the better it's going to be for your kids. Use your judgment about what you think is appropriate, of course. Like I said, we don't want to make them feel anxious. But there's nothing wrong with them saying you have a disagreement and resolve it, because guess what? They will have disagreements with their partners. Mm. In terms of assets, there are some questions you would be better placed to advise on. Absolutely. But thinking about that, you know, family trust structures, testamentary trusts, those kinds of things in terms of protection in case they do make a mistake or a partner turns out not to be what they thought they were, which I have to point out is common for women. One in six women will experience financial abuse in Australia. Mm. So there's some of those logistics behind that as well. But the best thing you can do is equip them to make good decisions by understanding the questions to ask and how to relate to people and showing that it's okay to talk about these things early and encouraging them to talk about it early.
Oh, that's fantastic advice. Well, I would say, okay, it's advice, but it's in your book, in a sense. It's not just
take it or leave it, everybody.
No, it's like, look, it's not just like we've got Lacey here just to talk about her opinions, which we do are very valuable, but it's in the book and we've only scratched the surface. I think that's the point of it, is that there's so much in this book that is here that I would really just digest it. And knowing as well that there's the audiobook, Lacey, I didn't know that that was an option.
And it's me.
Yes, audiobooks are, if you think you're time poor, you know, you can pop it in the car when you're driving. And I don't think you're really intending, if you're a parent trying to work through this with your kids, to try and do it all at once. So let's go, maybe if you can read 10 pages, you think that concept is something you can share at the dinner table, and then expand those conversations. And I'm just so grateful, Lacey, that you've been willing to be our guest number one on the Start Well podcast.
It's been a delight. Thanks so much for having me, Dawn. I love what you're doing and I really hope it helps.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. It's just really exciting that to know that parents, cool uncles, aunts, grandparents are going to go out there and get this book or audiobook and have those conversations with kids. I think that's just the most joyful part of all of this. Thank you so much, Lacey, fantastic. For the pitch.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me and best of luck to all of you. Congratulations on actually thinking about this stuff. You're definitely miles ahead just by thinking about it.
In the spirit of reconciliation, I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connection to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait peoples today. Thank you for joining us on this episode of Start Well and investing in the financial empowerment of young people. Please refer to the show notes for resources and links discussed in this episode. Subscribe now to get notified of the latest episodes as they drop weekly. And visit us on the Wealth Designer Start Well page for further resources to continue your knowledge journey.